Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him any more, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Megan. If you haven't met me before, I'm the senior minister here. And I'm nervous this morning. I'm not nervous because I'm telling you to stay weird, and I'm not nervous because we're looking at angels and demons. I'm nervous because there's so much material that everyone is going to be disappointed that they haven't had all their questions asked, answered, and you might feel that you're a bit overwhelmed, especially if you are a guest or a visitor today. I hope that you are able to find that there's material today that encourages you about reality, who you are, and what Jesus has done. I've got some books up the front that I've found useful as I've prepared for today, so you're welcome to come and have a look at those after the service. And I'm also more than happy to give you a copy of the slides and some of my notes if that would be useful to you. In the Herald Sun weekly magazine a couple of weeks ago, the cover story was about exorcisms. And apparently exorcisms are on the rise in Victoria. If you don't know what that word means, it means the casting out of demons from humans. And so there were a couple of Roman Catholic priests interviewed, a couple of Pentecostal pastors, and some mental health professionals and religious scholars. It was a pretty fair article, actually. Pauline brought it for me. I don't usually get the Herald Sun. But it was, it kind of talked about how people are seeking deliverance from evil in their lives and the way in which these Christians go about it. There was a note of caution, particularly around mental illness. But I think it was front page because it's just fascinating and weird to people. It's weird that in this day and age, we would still think that demons need casting out from people. It's weird that in this day and age, even progressive churches would be doing practices that seem medieval at best. So I wanted to ask the question in this Stay Weird series: should Christians still believe in angels and demons? And as we go through, you won't have every question that you've ever wanted to know answered, particularly maybe not about what do I do in the day-to-day, although we will get to a bit of that. But what I want to do is to give us a Bible worldview so that we know what Jesus did interacts with this belief in angels and demons, and so the importance of it for our faith today. So angels, what and why? Well, I've begun in the Old Testament, and my understanding is that spiritual, invisible beings created by God who inhabit the unseen heavenly realms are called angels, and they can engage with the physical world. They're a different type of creature to humankind. So you might have heard that we come from angels or that we turn into angels when we die. That's not the case. They're a separate order of being. They were created before humans. We don't have a lot of information about this, but we can see that they were there at the creation of the world rejoicing. This is sort of the Psalms language. They're able to take a form that is visible to humans if required, but this may or may not look human. So this is a little representation perhaps of what a spiritual being might look like in the visions of Ezekiel. Lots of wings, lots of eyes, symbolic of wisdom and movement and holiness. They were created as powerful beings to do God's will and be part of his ruling plans. And just like any king or ruler, they form part of a council, a divine council in this case, with delegated authority. So a king might have princes or sons or court attendants who would do his will and who may participate in the ruling of the kingdom. They would also be worshipful attendees at the heavenly royal court or around the throne. After the creation of humankind, angels were often tasked to be messengers and mediators between God and people, guiding, protecting, engaging with humans for the purposes of God. So we see in the Old Testament and the New Testament that angels were messengers. That's what the word angel means, messenger. But they would also engage with people in different ways so that God's mission and who God is was revealed to people. This is a picture of Jacob wrestling with the angel, and he didn't come to give a message, but he came to engage with Jacob on behalf of God. And the story actually moves between language of angel and God so that Jacob would know who he was and who God is. After the rebellion of some of their own kind, and we're going to talk about that plenty, and as humankind chose to sin and reject God's rule and ways, angels functioned as warriors in God's army. So you might have heard the language of the heavenly host or God of hosts, Lord of hosts, Yahweh Sabaoth, and that just means God of the heavenly armies, the heavenly hosts. They would enact God's just power against his enemies, especially at the last day. They functioned also in the present to protect those who are part of God's people against the enemies of God's people. And this was a physical and a spiritual promise. So we look in Psalm 91, he will command his angels concerning you. This was a promise to Israel. that they would be protected by God's heavenly host. So in summary, pretty easy, this is probably not very surprising to you, the purpose of these created spiritual beings was to worship God and to enact and protect God's good plans for his creation. We can see in the New Testament that they're following the same job description. There's worship and praise at the announcement of the birth of Jesus. There's rejoicing and praise over the return of one sinner into the fold. That's Luke 15. There's worship and praise around the throne of God in the book of Revelation. There's angels participating in the divine plan, enacting the judgment of God as both the warriors and the mediators of God's purposes for the world. So we see that they are the ones in Matthew 13 that are separating the weeds from the wheat, the righteous from the unrighteous. In Revelation, they're the ones tasked with the bowls of judgment in that vision, pouring out or mediating God's punishment on evil upon the world. They're there to announce key events in God's salvation plan, not just Christ's birth, hallelujah, not just then, but they're there at the resurrection of Jesus. They're saying to the women who come to the tomb, he's not here, he's risen. And in the promises of Jesus' return, Jesus says he will be coming with his angels. They communicate still in the New Testament God's guidance and instruction. So Joseph, stick with it, buddy. It's going to be good. Don't divorce Mary. Peter, go to Cornelius' house. The Gentiles are included in God's plan. Plenty of other things in the story that Timothy Lau recounted to us a couple of weeks ago of the shipwreck. The Apostle Paul has an angel come to him to say, this is what's going to happen in the shipwreck, this is what you should do. They still have the purpose of rescuing God's people. Peter's in prison and it says that an angel opened the doors and let him out. And they provide comfort and strength, particularly to the Messiah, Jesus, as he faces this task of redeeming the world. So what about the dark side then of spiritual beings? This is not the Christmas card Handel's Messiah moment, but it is actually a large bulk of what is happening in the New Testament. So I've got here, and I won't go through all of them, this is the list of every time in Mark's gospel, which is the shortest one, Jesus is engaging or his apostles are engaging with demons. And you can see let me bring some of the highlights. They recognize who Jesus is. Jesus begins his ministry by casting out an unclean spirit, and people bring all the sick and demon-possessed to him. He gives authority to his disciples to drive out demons. And he does it, he casts out demons sometimes in a way that seems to be connected to a medical condition. And sometimes, particularly like in our story today, something much greater is going on. There is an obvious non-human element to the affliction. The interesting thing to note when Jesus is casting out demons is the reaction of the Pharisees, the leaders of the Jewish people at the time, to what he's doing. So have a look right in the middle there, Mark 3. The scribes accuse Jesus of casting out demons by the power of Beelzebul. It's just another name for Satan that was used at the time. The prince of demons. And Jesus says, well, that's nonsense. Why would I be doing that? Why would a house be divided against itself? Why would I be ruining my own kingdom if I was part of the household of the demons. No, if I come among you and cast out demons, then the finger of God is on the move, and the kingdom of God is here. Matthew and Luke have many of the same examples of Jesus engaging with demons, but they also add some extra teaching. So in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 12, a similar discussion about by whose authority are you doing this takes place, and Jesus uses the illustration of the strong man. I am binding or tying up a strong being so that I can bring about freedom or take away that strong being's possessions. He also talks about an unclean spirit. When it leaves a person, that is not the final word on what needs to happen for that person to be healed and restored. So that's Matthew 12 there. You might know the story or the teaching about if an unclean spirit leaves and then there's nothing in its place, it will return with seven other spirits more wicked than itself. He, in Luke 10, talks about the way in which the disciples casting out of demons is actually a symbol of Satan's downfall. So if we go back to the beginning of the scriptures, let's have a look at some of the what and whys about demons. Originally, the same order of spiritual being, angels, who worshipped around God's throne and had authority in his ruling council. But just like us, these created invisible beings had free will. You can't have a being that worships that doesn't have free will, because worship needs to come from a heart that recognizes the glory of God and longs to ascribe him worth and value. So they had free will as well. And so some chose to reject God's rule and their role in his service. So this is from the book of Job, and it was new actually to me, because when I read the book of Job, I'm like, here are the highlights, and then there's all these speeches by Job's friends, and I never know whether I should be reading those speeches, because my kind of understanding of the book is, well, they're sort of saying unhelpful things to Job, so maybe I'll just skip to the end and see what God says, and I'm done. However, they actually are saying real theological things, true things, the friends. They're just applying it wrongly. That's the point of the book of Job. They don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And so one of the friends says this: if God places no trust in his holy ones, if even the heavens are not pure in his eyes, how much less mortals who are vile and corrupt, who drink up evil like water. So he's trying to say to Job, Job, it's very likely that you're a sinner and that's why you're suffering. But in doing so, he has given us this insight that at the time it was understood that even the holy ones, even the heavenly realms, had rebellion within them. They were not pure either. And so and maybe you're used to understanding this, but I found that helpful to know that there was material that kind of really clearly said the holy ones had rebelled. They're not pure either. Now, this choice to rebel against God by some of the angels may have had to do with jealousy or disagreement over the creation of humankind as image bearers. I mean, I like to think so. I'm pretty special, they must be jealous. There's not a lot of material about that, but a lot of people have thought about it. But it may simply have been about pride, selfishness, lust, and power. Just the usual suspects, pretty relatable. So we have here two little snippets from the Old Testament that may give us some information on this. Ezekiel 28 is talking about a human king, but it uses such heavenly imagery such spiritual imagery about this human king and such eternal consequence and beginning that it's, I think, quite likely that it's using an understanding that was already in the background for the Jewish people about what happened with spiritual beings, and it's applying it to the king of Tyre. So it says, "You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings." Pride, beauty, corruption of wisdom. I can do it better than you, God. Sounds familiar. And then in Genesis 6, maybe there's the motivation of lust. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God, this is language that's almost certainly referring to angels and not to human beings, saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. That's probably a very nice way of putting it. So we have a picture of spiritual beings who had free will and who chose to rebel, to oppose God, and to fight against him. So how did the fallen angels plan to win against God? Well, pretty easy. To take worship away from God and to destroy God's good plans for his creation. If it was the angels' job to bring worship to God and to protect and to enact God's good plans for his creation, then the rebellious ones would do the opposite. They would get worship for themselves, and they would destroy, they would seek to deceive, to kill, and to cause despair. So how did they do it? Well, in the Old Testament, we see these sorts of things. Temptation and deception of human beings, accusation and testing, inciting disobedience and sin, disturbance and harm to human beings. So that's King Saul experiencing an evil, tormenting spirit. Enticement to false prophecy, resisting angels who are sent to help God's people. If you were with us a couple of years ago for our Daniel series, you might remember the discussion between Michael, the prince of Israel, this angelic prince, saying the prince of Persia had held him up on his way to come and bring an answer to Daniel's prayer. Amplifying the evil and violence of human sinfulness. So this very strange story in Genesis 6 about these angelic beings and human wives is actually part of this cycle of increasing evil, wickedness and violence upon the earth. So it's within the first 11 chapters of Genesis, which is kind of all this prototypical teaching about what it means to be human, what the earth is like, what's wrong with the place, who God is, what God's going to do, why we're in the state we're in. And this picture of angelic engagement with human beings seems to be part of this increase of wickedness upon the earth. And it's just after that that the story of Noah and the flood happens. And false signs to lead people to false worship. So this quintessential moment in the history of Israel where they're slaves in Egypt and Moses is coming to Pharaoh and says, "See the power of God, you must let my people go." And every time he does something by the power of God, there's a matching false sign or wonder or miracle by the court magicians. And so Pharaoh thinks, yes, I'll follow God. Oh, no, I won't. My guys are just as good. And then it takes the final plagues or signs for the court magicians to say, we can't do this. We can't match this. This is the finger of God. But what we see with the way that evil beings are doing their work upon the world is that really it's a fatal partnership with human beings. So I was looking for a photo of a handshake or partnership, and I found this one, which is a little bit confronting, to be honest, because there's a gun there. But to me, it symbolised exactly the issue. There is a partnership, a fatal partnership. We engage with evil, but there's something behind it as well that's outside of our agency. At every point, we are given agency in how we will respond to God, just as the spiritual beings had agency as they would respond to God. But something happened as we listened to evil that brought a new and dark and destructive power into the world that is outside of our partnership as individuals with evil. So I've got three little examples of this fatal partnership in the Old Testament that connect to the New. The first, of course, is the engagement of the serpent with Eve and Adam in the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden was the holy place of God's royal rule and the centre from which human beings were to extend God's rule over the physical creation. And it was like a temple on earth. So when the temple was made later, it had all kinds of garden imagery in it, because Eden was like God's temple and humans were sort of there too, and also God's royal attendants, spiritual beings are there. And the serpent in the garden is a created being who's chosen to act against God's purposes. Now, we're very used to reading this like a kid's story and to seeing a little talking snake, but it's very unlikely that Genesis means for us to believe that Eve is naively talking to a normal animal. The word that is used for snake, normal, serpent, also gets used for shiny, bright, bronze, and diviner or divine mediator. So in Hebrew, there's kind of, just like we do, you can turn something into an adjective or a verb or a noun, and it's got all these little nuances behind it. So I really think, in the way that Genesis is meant to be read, in especially 1 to 11, and with these nuances to the word and the way in which the later believers would give insight to the text, Adam and Eve are engaging with one of God's spiritual attendants in Genesis 3, but one who no longer has their good or God's glory at heart and intends to lead them astray. So we see after Adam and Eve are cast out from the garden, angels are put there to guard. You know, this is the place. The attendants are here. The royal court is here. And so in Revelation 12, they say exactly that. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. There's a partnership here between Satan and human beings. There was agency on both sides. At any point, I guess Eve could have said, "No, thank you. I'm not going to listen to you." But instead, she and Adam take the handshake. The Old Testament implies that the serpent wasn't the only rebellious member of God's ruling council, but a group of spiritual beings began to exercise their wills against God. And they began to have authority over the nations of the earth who engaged in idolatrous worship. When a human worshipped an idol, they both worshipped nothing, no God. You know, the Bible says that's made by people. It's stone and wood, made by human hands. But the Bible also says that their heart is doing something else. They're worshipping spiritual beings opposed to the true God. So Deuteronomy 32 says, in a big long thing about the standard practice, idolatry of Israel, they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. The NIV is one of the very few translations that doesn't use the word demons there, and just keeps it in the kind of realm of idols, but it's a very striking Hebrew word that is, I think, most appropriately translated demons there, she says, not being a Hebrew scholar, but hey, I've read books. But the Apostle Paul says exactly the same thing in 1 Corinthians 10. He says, "Do I mean then that food sacrificed to an idol is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. But the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God. And I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than he?" So he's talking to them about participating in the normal sacrifices that were part of civic life in Roman society. And he says, yes, I know they're nothing, but there's also something behind them. In taking part, you are making a fatal partnership agreement with something evil. There also seems to be a connection or an interplay between a spiritual power over a nation and the human rulers of those nations. So Psalm 82, God presides in the great assembly, he renders judgment among the gods. It may be picturing God addressing either angelic beings who over a nation, it does use Elohim, sons of the Most High, or it could be speaking to human kings, or it could be speaking to both. There's a sense in which any corrupt human power actually has corrupt spiritual power behind it, and the two seem to be hand in hand. The heavenly realms and the earthly realms share some patterns of power when it comes to worship and rebellion. There's a fatal partnership. So what would God need to do to restore his good plans for his creation and to bring forth the worship he deserves from the whole cosmos? Well, he needs to deal with this fatal partnership, both parts, both parties, and that dark destruction that sits outside of that partnership too. So, the willful rebellion of humans would need to be atoned for and forgiven, and a new heart and a new spirit given to them. It's not just about taking the hand away, it's about changing what's inside that keeps saying yes. But that agreement itself, I need another person up here, that would be good, but then you'd be, that you wouldn't, no, no, no. The agreement humans made and make with evil when they worship things other than God would need to be broken, and the slaves bought back into freedom. That's the language of redemption, payment, ransom. And then that gun underneath, the power of Satan over the world, including the reign of death, would need to be defeated and all evil powers judged and destroyed. And so when Jesus comes on the scene, he's not simply engaging with human beings who have a tendency to refuse to worship God. He's engaging with human beings who are in a fatal partnership with evil and who also are in a kingdom of darkness and destruction. And that's why it is so easy for Jesus to love sinners because he knows that his struggle is ultimately not against these ones who are made in God's image, flesh and blood, but against the rulers and against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And if you remember nothing from this extremely lengthy sermon slash lecture, it is that we too are to know that our fight is not against human beings. If you don't believe in angels and demons, what do? You demonize humans. You say, you're the one that I need to destroy. But actually, that's exactly what the devil, Satan, loves to do. Destroy God's good creation. In fact, our fight is not against flesh and blood, but against the evil which we have partnered with and which holds us captive. So when Jesus meets the Gerasene demoniac, he meets someone who's not simply tormented in a human way, but who has this kind of supernatural power, who is clearly being destroyed from the inside out and a threat to society as well. So he's isolated away, he's living amongst the tombs. This is quintessentially the man who is under the power of the evil one, who wants to prevent worship and destroy God's good creation. And we see that it is a supernatural torment because this being knows who Jesus is. He says, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I recognize you. I know this business, and I know what you've come to do. You've come to deal with this, and you've come to deal with the dark and destructive power that is behind it." So Jesus says, "What's your name?" He says, "Legion, but don't send us out. We know that's your mission. Don't do it." And Jesus sends them among the pigs. And as soon as they go amongst these pigs, well, they do what they always do. They can't help it. Jesus has already described in his teaching that this is what evil does. You are a murderer from the beginning, he says, about Satan. And so they go into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. They both destroy and are destroyed. And this, even though it brings great relief and restoration to this one man who we see clothed and in his right mind, and I just think, oh, you would love to be in that moment, just that peace and restoration. But it's more than the individual blessing. This is a picture of exactly what Jesus has come to do to evil. He has come to drive it out by the finger of God. Do you remember what the magicians in Pharaoh's court said? They said when it got to that final, those final signs or plagues, we can't do this. This is the finger of God. And then the firstborn, and then the Exodus, then the crossing of the Red Sea, and then the destruction of Pharaoh's armies by drowning in the water. If you've been with us for the last couple of months, you'll know that Jesus didn't just do things to be mean to pigs or fig trees. This is a sign act to show exactly who he is, who we are, what his mission is, and what our future is. And so Jesus has brought us right back to the moment where God delivers Israel by the finger of God, casting them in, and all his enemies are destroyed and drowned. Isaiah 24 promised that this is what would happen. "In that day, the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens above and the kings on the earth below. They will be herded together like prisoners bound in a dungeon. They will be shut up in prison and be punished after many days. And then towards the end of the New Testament, Jude says, and the angels who did not keep their positions of authority but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the last day. That destruction that was coming and that was symbolized by the death of those pigs. Does sound horrible. They were going to be killed anyway and eaten. Just saying. So Jesus came to address this, the willful rebellion of humans, atoning and forgiving and giving a new heart and a new spirit. Jesus came to address the agreement that we make with evil when we worship things other than God, including ourselves, and buy back the slaves into freedom, clothed and in their right mind. But also to break the power of Satan over the world, including the reign of death, defeating it and destroying it entirely. Well, this is what Pedram asked me at the end of the sermon at 8 o'clock. Well, he didn't say that's all very well, because that would be rude, and I'm his boss. Should we engage directly with angels and demons today? I mean, I started with that article, right? Isn't that what you all really want to know? Well, the short answers. This is how we do it. We acknowledge the reality of angels and demons, knowing that they were a separate created order and that they are primarily God's responsibility. We don't call upon an angel directly. If God's choosing to send angels, we can ask for that. We can be thankful for that, but we don't engage with them directly. But if you have an experience with a spiritual being, whether you feel that was good or bad, I know that many of us have. The job is to ask God for lots of wisdom about it. Seek out the gift of distinguishing between spirits. There's got to be a reason it's there in the list. And share any message you've received, if there is something. It could have just been torment. That's different too. With Christians you trust to discern the way forward or what is needed to care for you. We need an entire series on all of this, so that's okay. New Testament tells us all to actively resist the devil, being aware that he is coming after people to deceive and destroy. I don't know exactly how he manages to do that, but I do know that in having a sermon today that was going to be declaring the defeat of the devil, it's been one of the most intense weeks of my entire life. So much stuff going on. Distraction, discouragement, real messy. I don't know, but I know my job is to resist the devil and he will flee. Put on the full armor of God, which is effective against the devil. And that sounds quite mystical, but if you take away some of the imagery in that passage from Ephesians 6, what is it? Truth, righteousness, the gospel of peace, faith, salvation, the word of God. These are the things that are accessible to every single person because of what Jesus has done. We proclaim the gospel because it is the way that people move from darkness to light. That is the destruction of the kingdom of the evil one, Jesus' death and resurrection. We don't have to try and engage the evil in the world outside of the gospel. There is no power outside of that. We pray for protection and deliverance from the work of evil always. It's in the Lord's Prayer. Deliver us from evil. It's intended for us to always pray. And I do think avoid direct engagement unless necessary. We don't run around seeking to engage with invisible spiritual beings. They are primarily God's responsibility. but they are there. And they do cause trouble and torment, and we could have, and we will do more on it next year. So when we do need to engage, particularly in prayer or caring for people or ourselves or a whole church or a week from heck, we ask Jesus to do the work. We have humility, wisdom, discernment, faith, peace, reliance on God's power. This is not something that we come with fear or pride. And we rest in Christ's victory and learn more about the scope of his work. With this picture in mind, this is the final thing we're finishing with. I want you to read this passage, which may be familiar to you, may not, from Hebrews 2. Understanding that the reason why we believe in angels and demons and that fatal partnership and the power of death that is in the world, the reason why is that because it helps us to understand and glorify the scope of Jesus' work. We actually can't understand the fullness of what Jesus has done for us without a supernatural worldview. So let's have a look at this and think about the handshake and the gun. Since the children have flesh and blood, Jesus too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might be able to make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. The work of Jesus atones for my sin. The work of Jesus helps me pull back my hand from entering into that agreement when I'm tempted. The work of Jesus breaks the slavery that I have to evil, death, and sin. And the work of Jesus breaks the power of evil and death.